Product Breakfast Club. Hey, everybody, it's Jonathan, host of the Product Breakfast Club podcast. Welcome, and I'm so happy you're here because today is a very special episode. I have interviewed one of my favorite authors of all time, Kim Scott. Now, let me tell you a little bit about Kim Scott. So Kim Scott is the founder of Candor Inc. and is a well-known CEO coach in Silicon Valley. She was a member of the faculty of Apple University, where she did a lot of teaching. And before that, she worked at Google, where she led AdSense, YouTube, and the DoubleClick teams. So basically, she's done a thing or two. So she's like a crazy popular Silicon Valley CEO coach. Earlier in her career, she was a co-founder and CEO of a software startup, managed a pediatric clinic in war-torn Kosovo, and built a diamond-cutting factory in Russia. What hasn't she done? I have no idea. I guess she also wrote this New York Times best-selling book called Radical Candor. So let me quickly tell you, I'm going to mention it in the interview with Kim. Radical Candor was a book that was, it just came into my life at the best possible time. It was when AJ and Smart was growing. AJ and Smart is the company I run. And I was having a lot of struggles as a manager, as a boss, as a CEO, still am today. But at that time, I was really struggling with all the new people coming in and just giving people feedback, like everything, like building teams. It was crazy. And somehow, and I really can't even remember why or where it came from, I picked up this book, Radical Candor, How to Be a Great Boss Without Losing Your Humanity. Picked it up and started reading it, and it completely blew me away. Best management book I've ever read in my entire life. Now, Kim only had a little bit of time. We had 30 minutes to do this call, and I tried to ask her everything possible. But to be honest, I had a whole hour more worth of questions that I want to ask her. So if you are a manager, if you're a boss, if you're a CEO, whatever it is, and you have to give feedback to other human beings, buy Radical Candor is the best book I've ever read on it. Stories from inside Apple, stories from Google about how Kim kind of got things moving. Just unbelievable, unbelievable. Honestly, that's it. I was a little bit nervous doing this interview because Kim is a total legend, but she was really great, a really great guest. And I really hope you enjoy this one. And make sure you go out and buy 300 copies of Radical Candor right now. I'll just stop for a second while you buy it. Just tap the one click. Yeah, there you go. Okay, now here's the interview with Kim Scott. Thanks so much for being on the podcast. Welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So Kim, I have to say, Radical Candor, if for some reason it was sitting on my desk for about, I would say, 6 months. I still don't know where the recommendation came from. I still don't even know why I picked it up. It was like one of the books on my pile. And I was going through kind of a tricky time running my company. Just for some context, I run a 20-person design studio in Berlin, Germany. And I picked up the book, I started reading it, and within about 1 hour, I realized that pretty much every single thing you pointed out in the book as being something as doing the wrong thing, I was doing every single possible imaginable. I just couldn't believe I'd never read this book before or that nobody had recommended it to me. It's completely insane. How are people like me allowed to work in places and lead people?
Well, you know, I asked myself the same question. We all get thrown into the deep end of management, and there's very little support or explanation of what the job is and how to do it. It's one of the strangest things. You spend years becoming an engineer or even learning how to sell. And yet, for one of the most important jobs that any of us ever have, we get very little help. And I love your story. I love it when it's like the universe sends you a book. It's happened to me many times. So I'm thrilled that you found it helpful.
Yeah, it was really huge for me. I think I was also embarrassed while reading it. I remember like reading it and just kind of my face going red, reading some of these stories because I noticed a lot of the things that I'd been doing wrong. It was almost like I just didn't think anyone else was experiencing any of the same things, but they're so specifically the same problems that I was having that it was really, really amazing.
I felt the same way about writing it. I felt almost embarrassed to tell all these stories on myself. But they're such important shared experiences, and we all go through it.
And I think, like, for me, maybe that's like something to get into. For me, what really kicked it off and the story in the book, the first bit of very harsh feedback that you received from your boss at Google. Would you mind telling that story?
Sure, absolutely. Harsh but kind at the same time. I think it's really the best way to explain Radical Candor is to explain a time when my boss criticized me. So I had just taken a new job at Google, And I had to give a presentation to the founders and the CEO about how the AdSense business was doing. And I walked into the room, and there was Sergey Brin, one of the founders, on a elliptical trainer in toe shoes. And there was Eric Schmidt, who was CEO at the time of Google, reading his email. And he's so deep into his email, it's like his brain has been plugged into his machine. And like any normal person, I felt a little bit nervous. How in the world was I supposed to get these people's attention? Luckily for me, the business was on fire. And when I said how many new customers we had added, Eric's head jumped up out of his machine and he looked at me and he said, "That's amazing. What do you need? Do you need more marketing dollars? Do you need more engineers?" So I'm feeling like the meeting's going pretty well, right? In fact, I'm feeling like a genius. And as I left the room, I passed by my boss, who was Sheryl Sandberg, and I'm expecting a high five or a pat on the back or something. And instead, Sheryl says to me, "Why don't you walk back to my office with me?" I thought, oh boy, I screwed something up, and I'm sure I'm about to hear what it was. And Sheryl began the conversation by telling me about the things that had gone well in the meeting, not in a feedback sandwich. I think there's a less polite term for that.
A shit sandwich, I think.
Yes, exactly. Not in that kind of way, but genuinely seeming to mean what she was saying and also really teaching me something, telling me stuff I didn't already know. But of course, all I wanted to hear was what I had done wrong. And eventually, Sheryl said to me, "You said a lot in there. Were you aware of it?" And I sort of made this brush off gesture with my hand and breathed a huge sigh of relief, because if that was all I had done wrong, who really cared? And
right.
I said something like, "It's just a verbal tick. It's no big deal." And then Sheryl stopped and she sort of looked at me and she said, "I know this really good speech coach. Google would pay for it, I bet. Would you like an introduction?" And once again, I made this brush off gesture with my hand. And I said, "No, I'm busy. Didn't you hear about all those new customers? I don't have time for a speech coach." And then Sheryl looked me right in the eye and she said, "I can tell when you do that thing with your hand that I'm going to have to be a lot more direct with you. When you say every third word, it makes you sound stupid." Now she has my full attention. Some people might say it was mean of Sheryl to say that I sounded stupid, but it was actually the kindest thing she could have done for me at that moment in my career. Because if she hadn't said it to me just that way, and she wouldn't have said it to other people just that way,
right,
I wouldn't have gone to see the speech coach. And when I did, it's sort of one of life's most painful experiences is to watch yourself on video. But when I did, I realized Sheryl wasn't exaggerating. I literally said every third word. And this was news to me because I had gone through my entire career giving presentations. I had raised millions of dollars for two startups giving presentations. I thought I was pretty good at it. And it was like I had been walking through my entire career with a giant hunk of spinach between my teeth, but nobody had had the common courtesy to tell me that it was there. So this really got me to thinking, what was it about Sheryl that made it so seemingly easy for her to tell me? And perhaps even more interestingly, why had no one else told me? And as I thought about it, I realized that in the case of Sheryl, it really boiled down to two things. I knew that Sheryl cared about me, not just as an employee, but as a human being, as a person. She cared personally about me, and not just me, but everyone who worked directly for her and with her. So, for example, when I moved from New York to California to take the job, Sheryl could tell I was lonely, and she knew I loved to read, so she invited me to join this great book group. And when I had a family member fall ill, she said, she could tell I was upset, and she said, "You go to the airport right now, get on a plane. I'm going to write your coverage plan. We've got your back." That's what teammates do for each other. And that was the sort of thing that Sheryl did for every single person who she worked most closely with. She couldn't, of course, do it for all 4,000, 5,000 people in her organization. Relationships don't scale no matter how talented you are. But for the people who worked closely with her, it was a real human relationship. It was different from a friendship. It wasn't a friendship, but it was a real human relationship. But she never let her concern for our short-term feelings get in the way of telling us things that we really needed to know, that we really needed to hear about. And so it was sort of simple. It was challenge directly and care personally at the same time. And that was sort of the essence of good guidance, both praise and criticism.
And I think the really interesting thing about it is if you think about it, most bosses, or at least most managers I've had in my life, and including myself until I read this book, probably wouldn't have said anything, or maybe would have tried to hint at it in a weird way, but not have like just come straight out and said it.
Yes. And if you look at the story, it's interesting. Cheryl started by hinting, but it was pretty clear to her that I wasn't getting the hint. And that's what's so important, is knowing when to move further out on the challenge directly dimension of radical candor, and knowing when to move higher up on the care personally dimension of radical candor. So because Cheryl was talking to me in person, and because she could see me making this brush off gesture with my hand,
right,
she knew that what she had to do was move further out on the challenge directly dimension. And that's what's so hard. Your job as a boss is to make things clear to people. And very often we'll actually say the thing, but we won't be heard. And it's our job to make ourselves heard. And sometimes the key to making yourself heard is to take a moment and to address the emotions in the room and to reassure someone that the reason you're telling them this thing is that you care about them and that you care about their professional growth. But very often, the job of the boss is to move further out on the challenge directly dimension. Sometimes giving feedback feels like you're having to pick up a 2x4 and hit somebody over the head to get through to them. And you don't want to be mean. And that's good. That's a good thing. When you realize that it's unkind not to be clear, then you're cooking with gas as a manager.
Right. And I think in the book, you have this 2x2 framework to describe this, which is essentially on the top right, you have radical candor. On the bottom right, you have obnoxious aggression. Bottom left, manipulative insincerity. That's hard for me to say as an Irish person. And on the top left, you have ruinous empathy. And for me, this top left quadrant of ruinous empathy, I think that's where I was pretty much sitting until I read this book. I think that's where most managers that I've had in my life were sitting. And I have the feeling, and also, I mean, you said in your book as well, that this is like really one of the most common mistakes that managers make or bosses make, is sort of being in this top left quadrant of ruinous empathy. Maybe you could go into that for a little bit.
Yes, absolutely. Because what you say is so true. There's a lot of ways to get radical candor wrong. So when you do care personally and challenge directly at the same time, that's radical candor. When you do challenge directly, but you fail to show you care personally, that's what I call obnoxious aggression.
Right.
And I want to talk about it for just a second before I move to ruinous empathy, because the stories that we tell about obnoxious aggression are fun.
Yeah.
When I first started developing this framework, I called obnoxious aggression sort of the asshole quadrant.
Yeah.
And I stopped doing it for a very important reason. And the reason is that when I called it the asshole quadrant, people would use the framework to start writing names in boxes. But the fact of the matter is, these are mistakes that all of us make all the time. I've been a jerk. You've been a jerk. Every single one of your listeners has been a jerk, probably at least once already today. You know, it's a mistake that we all make, but it's not the most common mistake we make. Now, before I move on to ruinous empathy, it's worth sort of double clicking on what happens when we realize we've been a jerk, because the temptation when you realize you have been unkind to someone is, instead of moving up on the care personally dimension and attending to the emotions, it's tempting to just back off your challenge and say, oh, I didn't really mean it.
Okay.
No big deal. And that lands us in the worst place of all, manipulative insincerity, where we neither care nor challenge.
Right.
And that's also fun to tell stories about. It's fun to tell stories about passive-aggressive behavior. It's fun to tell stories about backstabbing behavior, about political behavior. But as you say, by far the most common mistake we make is the one that I call ruinous empathy, where you do care about the other person's feelings and you care so much that you fail to tell them something they really need to hear. So here's my ruinous empathy story. You ready?
Yeah, hit me.
Cool. So I was managing this guy, we'll call him Bob, and I really liked Bob a lot. He was smart, he was charming, he was funny. He would do stuff like, we were at one of those manager offsites that takes forever and everybody's stressed out and would frankly rather be working, but nobody wants to be the jerk who says, hey, I don't have time to play this get to know you game. Let's move on. So Bob was the person in the room who had the courage to say, hey, listen, this is taking a long time and I can see we're all really stressed. I've got a great idea that'll help us get to know each other better and it'll just take a minute. If it was fast, we were ready to agree to do it, whatever it was. And Bob says, let's just go around the room and confess what candy our parents used when potty training us. Weird, but fast.
Okay.
And then for the next 10 months, every time there was a tense moment in a meeting, Bob would whip out just the right piece of candy for the right person at the right moment. It was so funny. So weird, but charming and funny. Kind of an example of why we liked working with Bob. There was one problem with Bob. He was doing terrible work. Absolutely terrible work. I was so puzzled because he had this incredible resume, all these past accomplishments. I learned later that the problem was that Bob was smoking pot in the bathroom three times a day, which maybe explained all that candy he had at all times. But I didn't know any of that at the time. All I knew was that Bob was turning in work that was almost laughably bad. And I didn't know what to do because I didn't want to hurt Bob's feelings. So I would say something like, oh, Bob, this is a great start, but you're so smart. You're so awesome. We all love working with you. Maybe you could make it just a little bit better, some version of that. And, you know, we've all heard that, right?
I've heard me saying it.
Yes. And you've probably had it said to you as well. At least I certainly have.
Yeah, for sure.
And so Bob didn't hear that there was a problem. And this goes on for 10 months. All Bob's colleagues are having to cover for him. And why am I saying that? I'm saying it partly because I really do care about Bob's feelings. I mostly don't want to hurt them. So it's mostly ruinous empathy. But it's also worth admitting that there was a dose of manipulative insincerity in there too, because Bob was really well liked on the team. And Bob was also kind of sensitive. And I was afraid, not just for Bob's feelings, that's the ruinous empathy part, but I was also afraid for my reputation. I was afraid that if I told Bob in no uncertain terms that his work wasn't nearly good enough, that he would get upset or maybe even start to cry, and everybody would think I was a big jerk. And I didn't want that to happen. So I gave Bob this feedback that was basically just a head fake, a lie, really. And after 10 months, the inevitable happens. And I realize that if I don't fire Bob, I'm going to lose all the best performers on the team because they're fed up. They're sick of having to redo his work. So I sat down to explain to Bob where things stood. And when I finished, he sort of pushed his chair back from the table. He looked me right in the eye and he said, "Why didn't you tell me?" Painful, right? As that question is going around in my head with no good answer, he looks at me again and he says, "Why didn't anyone tell me? I thought you all cared about me." And now I realize that I have failed Bob in a bunch of really important ways. I have failed to solicit feedback from Bob. Maybe I was doing something that was driving him so crazy he was forced to toke up in the bathroom, right? I don't know. And I never will because I didn't ask him. I didn't solicit guidance, praise, and criticism, most importantly, criticism from Bob. I also failed to give him praise that was meaningful. The kind of praise I gave him was really just a head fake or an ego salve. And I failed to tell Bob when his work wasn't nearly good enough. So I failed to give Bob criticism. And probably worst of all, I failed to create the kind of environment in which everyone would give Bob the kind of praise and the kind of criticism he needed to be successful. in which everyone would tell Bob what was genuinely good about his work and also working with him, but also would tell Bob when he was going off the rails. And because I had failed in all these different, very important ways, I'm now having to fire Bob because of it. All along, I had just been trying to be nice, but I realized it was not so nice after all. But the problem here was that it was too late to save Bob. All I could do in the moment was make myself a very solemn promise that I would never make that mistake again, and that I would do everything in my power to help other people prevent making that mistake. And that's why I came up with the Radical Candor Framework and wrote the book, and why I've started with two other people this great company that helps people do workshops and learn more about how to avoid those terrible Bob moments, because they are so painful. Of course, it was worse for Bob than for me, but it was painful for everybody. Painful for Bob, painful for me, painful for the team.
Do you do those workshops in Europe as well, by any chance?
We do, absolutely.
Really? I know a lot of companies, including myself, who might need some of that radical candor action.
Great.
That last story brought up so many things. I know we only have 19 minutes exactly left, but I'm going to try to go through them. It's a few comments and questions. The first thing is, I think people naturally want people to like them. And I think when you're going into I can only speak for myself as a founder, but I've seen this with a lot of my managers as well. I naturally want my employees to like me, to like the environment. I guess it's like a selfish thing, but that's one of the biggest reasons why I was in this sort of ruinous empathy quadrant. I didn't want to give people the hardcore feedback. I just wanted them to feel good and to coast along until the moment where they got fired and were completely confused about why that happened. And I think that's the worst thing. And that was always like the worst thing that happened, is when I would fire somebody and they would just be like, hey, I didn't expect that. That just came out of nowhere.
Yes.
And that's what happens when you're in this like ruinous empathy quadrant, because you're just being nice the whole time. You're just putting them off the whole time. In the meantime, they're at your company for 3 years and they're not growing. They're not improving. They're probably getting worse. And afterwards, they feel like everyone thought they were stupid. Now you're telling them right at the end when it's way too late, just because you wanted people to like you. That's one of the reasons I had such a red face reading the book.
Well, look, I think you're being a little bit hard on yourself. It's the most natural thing in the world to want to be liked. I think one of the things that I try to do when I coach leaders is to talk to them about channeling that normal and basically positive human instinct, but channeling it outward, not inward. So don't worry so much about whether or not people like you, but focus on whether or not you're doing the kind thing for those other people. Are you putting their interests ahead of your own interests? And that makes it much easier to do the things you need to do to be an effective leader, because I think that very often we have this notion that we have to choose between being a total jerk and being really effective. And that's a false choice. We don't have to make that choice.
That's a really, really good point. Another thing that came up, or that comes up a lot if you kind of stay in this ruinous empathy quadrant, and I know that sounds really cold in German, but I'm living in Germany, okay? And it's that you have a lot of weaker employees hanging around for a long time in the company.
Yes.
And what starts to happen, and you bring this up, is that me as a manager, or managers in general, they tend to spend more time on the people who are struggling than the people who are nailing it. And that really, really sucks for the people who are nailing it. And we become these absentee managers. That's a really, really interesting thing you brought up. Could you go a tiny bit into that?
Sure, absolutely. I think one of the most important mantras for a manager is to keep your star performers top of mind, to keep people who are doing the best work for the team top of mind. That's not to say you don't care at all about the people who are not doing good work, but if you really focus on putting your time into helping the people who are doing the very best work continue to improve, on being a really good thought partner for those people, you will help not only those people, but the whole team. If you think about your time, pretend that it's money. Would it be fair to give equal bonuses to everybody, regardless of performance? No, obviously that wouldn't be fair. The same thing is true of your time. Your time is really a valuable currency, and you should invest it where you and the team are going to get the biggest returns.
Right.
So another reason why people often fail to invest their time with the people who are doing the very best work on the team is that they don't want to micromanage those people.
Yes.
And some people even will say, you know, my approach to management is to hire right and then give them full autonomy and basically ignore them. And that's sort of like saying the best way to have a good marriage is to marry the very right person and then refuse to spend another moment with that person.
I love it.
It's not a recipe for a happy relationship. So if you remember that you really do need to spend time with all of your employees, but it's not unfair to spend more time with the people who are doing the best work. In fact, that's the best allocation of your time. You'll wind up having a more successful team. I mean, all of these things are guidelines, not rules. There are times when you do need to spend a lot of your time with a poor performer. Managing someone out takes a lot of time. And making sure that you're doing the things that you have to do legally, if it gets to the point that you have to fire someone, that just takes time, unfortunately. Yeah. It's the worst part of being a manager, but doing it right really matters.
And one of the interesting things that you said as well, I'm just going to quote straight from the book, is that if you're focusing on these star performers, then you're moving from great to stunningly great. And that's like something that inspires people a lot more than just moving from bad to mediocre. So I think that's like, for me, that was a big kicker where I was like, damn it, you know what? I am actually focusing so much time on people who are only going to get like 10% better. And my star performers, I don't remember the last time when I actually had a one-on-one with one of them, actually.
Yeah. And it's a mistake we've all made. But management is not Marxism, right? You don't need to give all your time to the people who are neediest.
Right. There is something that I wanted to ask you now. It's kind of breaking slightly out of topic, but it's a genuine question that I still had after finishing the book. And I've been trying to implement it at my company, but I'm having a little bit of trouble with it. So in the book, you talk about doing one-on-ones with your direct reports. So essentially having time in the week for having these one-on-one sessions with your direct reports. This is like such a specific selfish question for me that's been the podcast. I love it. I'm not 100% clear on what those one-on-ones should look like.
Right. Here's the way that I like to do them. There's no one size fits all answer to the question. But basically for me with one-on-ones, I would have my direct reports set the agenda. So this was a time for us to talk about whatever was on their mind. And really, I would remind people that anything was fair game, from strategy to furniture to stuff going on in your personal life. The one-on-one was the time I set aside for each direct report to talk to me about what was on their mind. And I would use just a shared Google document where they would put the agenda in. Some people are more structured, other people are less structured. I'm very unstructured. So there was no rules about when you had to have your agenda in. But if they wanted to fill it out 2 minutes before the meeting with simple bullet points, that was fine with me. Because it was, again, their time to make use of in the way that worked for them. And I tried to make sure that it wasn't a status report, but where I was really helping them clarify their thinking around the work that they were doing and the new ideas that they had, that this was the time to really, for me, to help them problem solve. One of the things I learned in my career was that often I would ask people early in my career to come, if they had a problem, to come with 3 solutions and a recommendation. And I realized that if I insisted on that I wasn't helping them think through problems. So in the one-on-one, you could just come with a problem and we would brainstorm together. It was kind of a more open-ended time. But then the other thing that I like to do in the one-on-one was to save a few minutes at the end to solicit feedback.
Okay.
A common mistake that people make with one-on-ones is they save up feedback to give to their direct reports. And that feedback is much better delivered in these impromptu 2-minute conversations in the moment. Don't save it up for a one-on-one. But the one-on-one is a good time to make sure you are on a regular basis asking what you could do or stop doing that would make it easier for that person to get their work done.
And do you do those about once per week?
Yes. I always try to have a maximum of 7 direct reports, ideally 5 direct reports. And the reason for 5 is that I like to have those meetings over lunch so it feels more like you're catching up with someone, getting to know them better rather than a meeting. Sometimes I like to do them instead of over lunch, over a walk, take a walk together. As I get older, the less meals and the more walks I take, the better. So the other thing that's really important about a one-on-one, just to make sure you don't cancel it, is to really treat it like some time you get to spend with someone who you're really interested in getting to know better.
Yeah.
Because if you change your mindset around it, these should be some of your most enjoyable meetings of the week. It shouldn't feel like calendar clutter or something like that. And that's why it's useful to do it over lunch or over a coffee or taking a walk or in some sort of way that the human connection is more likely to be front and center than the updates or the agenda or anything like that.
Yeah, great. I'm just going to then kind of jump out of that. There's definitely a big thing I wanted to ask you about. And it's something that I've personally been criticized. And a couple of other CEOs that I know here in the city, I know they're also not very good at it. And it's also not natural. And it's giving praise.
Yes.
And I was listening to one of your podcasts recently, and you were talking about like, help them find the place to scratch on your back.
Yes.
Could you maybe like help me a little bit understanding like how to give praise to people?
Sure. I mean, if you think about praise and criticism, praise helps people see what to do more of, and criticism helps them see what to do less of. And if you think about management as asking somebody to scratch you on the back, if you don't tell them where to go, like, yes, go that direction, no, don't go that direction, it's just dumb luck if they find the right spot to scratch. So it's not like you should treat all your employees like your own personal back scratchers.
Damn it. That's what I got from it.
But it was sort of a useful metaphor for me of helping people know when to go in the right direction and also when they're going in the wrong direction. If you think about it, another metaphor is skiing. If you're skiing down a slope through the trees, if you focus too much on the trees, you're more likely to hit them. You want to focus on the space between the trees, and that's praise. And you're more likely to get safely down the hill if you focus on positive target identification. So your job as a leader is to fundamentally show people what success looks like. And praise is a much more powerful tool for showing people what success looks like than criticism. Criticism just shows them what it doesn't look like.
I have to just tell you that we have within AJ and Smart, one of the solutions that we've tried out and we're trying out right now is something called Bonusly, and it's a kind of way that people can give bonuses within the company. One of my worries about that, and I guess I'm just going to straight out say that one of the reasons I don't like it is because it has kind of descended into being something that is about making people feel good rather than it's all about making people feel good. And that's kind of where praise is starting to go in my company. Whereas I feel like there's something about that that I'm really not liking. I just don't know what it is.
Well, I think that these programs where you encourage people to say something nice are actually really important because it often doesn't come naturally, not only to CEOs, but to employees. So one of the most powerful systems at Google for this was a peer bonus system that's sort of not so dissimilar to Bonusly. But I found the most effective way to get people giving each other praise that was meaningful was simply to buy a stuffed killer whale. And at the beginning of my all hands meeting every week, I would say, now what I want to do is I want to hear from people about others on the team who've done something exceptional this week, something you really appreciated for whatever reason, either because the work was exceptional or because they were exceptionally kind to you, the teamwork was exceptional. And I would just get people telling stories about one another, positive stories, not negative stories, and praising one another in public. And it did a lot to create a culture of praise, helping people give voice and tell the stories about exceptional work, and just giving a little space for it every week was really important. So that can also work. And I think is a good complement. My concern with things like Google's peer bonus system or Bonusly is that when you make it about an extrinsic reward, about money,
right,
it has a paradoxical effect of cheapening the work. I'll never forget one time I was working at a company and they had bought these Starbucks gift certificates. And like, so somebody had done something quite remarkable that saved the company like $15 million.
I see where this is going.
And they got a $25 Starbucks gift certificate. It was ridiculous. You know, it would have been better to just tell the story or give the person a better bonus. But yeah, that's not always a possibility. And it's so hard to correlate often the work and the impact of the work and the bonus. But telling stories is almost always effective.
That's really great. Okay, Kim, I have millions of other questions to ask you, but I'm going to actually let you get back to work. But before I do, I'm just going to ask you, where can people find you online?
Oh, thank you. So radicalcandor.com is our website, and we've got a lot of information about the keynotes and the workshops, and we do blog posts there. And you can also submit your radical candor sort of questions or conundrums. If you try something in the book and it's not working, we love to hear radical candor on radical candor. We also love to hear about what does work, but we love to hear about what's not working for you. And we'll give free advice on the site. And also, buy the book.
How many copies should they buy each? Like, if I want to be a really good manager, do I need like 50 copies in my house or like 100? Like, it's about the amount of books.
More books is always good. But in all seriousness, make sure you give it to people who will read it. Plant it definitely where it will grow.
How can I give it to somebody? Because it's an insult. It feels like an insult if I give it to somebody.
Give it to somebody with love. Give it to somebody and point out there's something you do as a manager that I really appreciate. And it was described here. So if they give good praise, tell them that.
I love it.
Every manager does something right. So give it with a story about something you really like.
Perfect, Kim. Thanks so much for being on the podcast. Have a good one.
Thank you so much. Really enjoyed the conversation.
Ho, ho, ho. Welcome back to the Product Breakfast Club podcast. Even though you're here the whole time, I make that joke every time. It's not funny. I really hope you enjoyed that interview. It was so, so cool for me to be able to chat to Kim. She's got a lot of energy. She's a really great storyteller. And Jesus, seriously, if it wasn't made clear already, you got to buy this book, okay? It's completely changed my life, completely changed. Everybody I've given this book to has just been like, holy shit, I can't believe I didn't know this shit. Now, that's pretty much it. I hope you enjoyed that episode. If you did enjoy this episode of the Product Breakfast Club, we do love your 5-star reviews. I know you hear this from every podcast person and you just never do it. I understand. I understand that almost nobody does. We've got thousands and thousands and thousands of people listening to the podcast, but we don't have that many thousands of reviews. If you're wondering how to review it, all you got to do right now, if you're on an iPhone, just pop out your iPhone, open up the podcast app if you have it. If not, download it. I don't know where you're listening to this on. And just give it a 5-star review. And why? Because if you give it a 5-star review and leave a little comment, then more people will find this podcast. And another thing you can do if you're an Android user, and also if you're iOS, is just to share, let somebody know about this podcast. It honestly, it helps us. You can hear there's no sponsors or anything on this. It's all love. And also brand building and all that. Never mind. It's all love. That's what it's about. So you can find me at JIceCream on Instagram. You can find Jake, who's usually my co-host, at Jake K on Twitter. Until next week, have a good week, everybody. Product Breakfast Club.